So thank you, Vice Chancellor, and thank you everyone for being here today. It took a little while, but I hope you enjoy it. And I thought I should start my lecture by explaining the title. Hixum Leones is an expression that came about at the time of medieval cartographers who used to put dragons or lions or other wild beasts, sea monsters, to indicate either dangerous territories or places which had not been explored before. And as a little girl, I used to wonder about new things and wanted to know about new things. And I like to think that the work of physicists and the work of scientists in general is not too dissimilar for the, from the kind of aspirations of explorers. And that's how I chose the title the moment that I was told I was going to give this lecture. Ptolemy was one of such great cartographers of antiquity. In fact, he was a bit of an eclectic thinker of his time. He was an astronomer, a geographer. He also delved in mathematics and even astrology. It's probably best known for the geocentric model, which was for a long time the favorite cosmology until during the Renaissance, about 1,000 years after Ptolemy, it was replaced by Copernican heliocentrism. And he, amongst the many things that he wrote a treatise called Geography, where he listed all the coordinates of the known places of his time, and he also gave instructions on how to compile maps from those coordinates. The things that he had were used at his time and afterwards to construct maps like this one of the whole inhabited world and the Roman provinces, including Britain. And the whole world was known as Ecumeni by Ptolemy. As you can see from the map of Britain and the British Isles, it wasn't terribly accurate. You can recognize roughly the structure of Britain and Ireland, but it isn't nearly as close to kind of the usual maps that we see of Great Britain and Ireland as we see in geography books nowadays. With the passing of time, though, knowledge increased. Explorers during the golden age of exploration and discovery in the Renaissance started to give more accurate data. And this is Framaurus' map, which is possibly the best testimony to the greatness of medieval cartographers. Framaurus was kind of relatively humble, I would say, lay brother who, on commission of the Signoria of Venice, with his workshop, with his collaborators, we would say today, it's probably similar to what we're doing in particle physics, they constructed this map, where he broke tradition with, he broke away with tradition. For example, you will notice that the south is at the top and the north is at the bottom. And with another break of tradition, he removed Jerusalem from the center of the world. He gave justification as to why he needed to do that. But really, other things that he did was to put various kind of celestial objects or religious objects or religious kind of understanding of cosmology. He still kept them on his map, but he didn't put them in the map. He kind of wanted to make it clear that this was kind of scientific. Talking of dragons, another thing that he did was to have an island around here. This is kind of the boundaries of the world as he knew it and understood it through the information that he got from cartographers, including Ptolemy, but also from travelers of his time. It's quite possible that he would have read the writings of Marco Polo. And he put this little island here, one of those here in the Atlantic Ocean, and he called it the Island of Dragons. There's lots of hundreds of locations and thousands of detailed descriptions. And there is this Island of Dragons just off the shores of modern-day Senegal, although in various other parts he seemed to be rather skeptical of the existence of such kind of mythological creatures. It was a lot more precise, and NASA recently demonstrated that. This is from our map on the left, and on the right it's an image obtained from satellites from NASA with the same orientation as from Mauro's map, and I hope you will agree with me that it's quite remarkable. From Mauro's, like many educated people of his time, understood Earth to be a sphere, and he actually estimated the circumference of the Earth to within 10%, which again is quite remarkable, I think, for the time in which this map was produced. I thought I couldn't skip showing this image, not because it has anything to do with my lecture, but because I think it's beautiful and because this is where I come from. This is roughly where I come from. This is roughly where I studied at uni. And then I moved up and up and up, and going through Geneva, came here to Brighton. And some people will say that this is a map of light pollution of Italy. But I think it's just fantastic, and it's a testament to the ingenuity of scientists that we can enjoy images such as this one. But going back to science and the Large Hadron Collider and exploration, the explorers of from Mauro's time used the best instruments at their disposal to produce the maps that we have seen. Scientists, the explorers of modern days, also use the best instruments at their disposal, and they make the most accurate measurements and possibly discoveries that is kind of achievable with the instrumentations that we have. And we produce our own kind of maps. For example, this one is a map of the variations of the so-called cosmic microwave background, which is constructed from kind of putting together astronomical observations, as well as particle physics knowledge, as well as lots of work by theoreticians, many of which I see here in this room. And the reason why this is interesting to me as a particle physicist, as well as someone who's curious about nature, is because this map has the imprint from the existence of this dark substance that fills the universe, which we call dark matter, which is a really important component of the universe, except that we don't know anything about it. We only know that it exists. And it is through exploration of space and by looking at the sky that we have a clear, indirect, but firm evidence of the existence of dark matter. This is another map, if you wish, that still kind of adds substance to kind of the hypothesis of dark matter. This is the ABLE 1689 cluster. And the image that you're seeing isn't exactly as it comes out of the Hubble telescope, but kind of superimposing the images that come from Hubble plus interpretation of those images plus kind of time-consuming and clever analysis of those observations by looking at a phenomenon called gravitational lensing, where you kind of see distortions in the light. It is possible to map out the presence of dark matter again in this cluster, a cluster which is depicted in kind of lightish blue in this photo. Particle physicists also have their own map of the Acumeni, and we call it the standard model of particle physics. And this is kind of a schematic description of the standard model, where we have quarks and leptons in the outer wheel. These are the matter particles which interact with one another by exchanging force particles, the photon, the gluon, the W and the Z. I'll come back to all of this in a little while. And then it also accommodates this special particle, the Higgs boson, which was discovered in 2012 by ATLAS, my own experiment, and our competitor, CMS, and kind of demonstrated the existence of the Higgs field, which fills the universe and which kind of explains the mechanism whereby elementary particles acquire a mass that is different from zero. But as I said, I'll come back to all of this in a little while. So by putting together models and observations and experiments and all our knowledge, we have been able to establish what is today the kind of prevalent theory for cosmology and for the kind of evolution of the universe, which according to the Big Bang Theory, which has nothing to do with the TV show if you ever watch it, but in the Big Bang Theory, the universe is understood to be evolving from a really dense and really hot state early on to a much cooler and much less dense state. And by looking at the kind of studying the rate of expansion of the universe, which has been expanding and cooling down ever since, we know that we can measure, remarkably, we can measure the age of the universe, which is of about 13.7 billion years, give or take a few hundred million years. And early on, when it was really, really hot, all the forces were unified, and then it became cold enough for elementary particles to appear, and then for elementary particles to coalesce into kind of bound states of nucleons, protons, and neutrons, and also we still had the electrons, and then from protons and neutrons and electrons, we began to have the kind of light elements in the universe, and then from under the action of gravity, those clouds of light elements in the universe have started to form a nebula, and then galaxies, and then stars, and planets, and the universe as we know it today. Now, you would have seen that there's this arrow going left to right, which is time, and another arrow which is right to left, which is temperature, if you wish, energy. So if we can produce particles at a very high energies, which is what we do in the Large Hadron Collider, we are essentially running this movie backwards, and kind of as if we were using some sort of time machine by colliding particles at the energies of the Large Hadron Collider. We are essentially in the lab looking at what the conditions were in the universe shortly after the Big Bang. In fact, a split second after the Big Bang, 1/10 of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. So the Large Hadron Collider is this gigantic accelerator which is located underground across the border between France and Switzerland. It's a 27-kilometer ring, which at it's on a slightly inclined plane, and at its deepest, it reaches about 100 meters underground. My own experiment, I already said that in passing, is called the Atlas experiment, like the Atlas god of antiquity, and it's just a few hundred meters in a cavern, about 30 meters underground, a few hundred meters from CERN's main entrance. And CERN is this, its largest particle physics lab in the world. It's, I dare say, the most important particle physics lab in the world, and it was created shortly after World War II to kind of initiate and encourage collaboration amongst international scientists. You can think of it as some sort of United Nations of particle physics. And just to give you an example of how big 27 kilometers are, I've made this picture with 27-kilometer circle centered, unfortunately, not on University of Sussex, but on the American Express Stadium, because I thought they would be even more easily recognizable by the general public. So it's really big. And we collide protons. Protons are nothing else than the nuclei of hydrogen atoms. So hydrogen atoms stripped off their only electron that kind of orbits around the nucleus. And we collide them at unprecedented high energies. And they go really, really fast. They're only, about one part in 100 million times slower than the speed of light. And that's because they have a mass, while photons haven't got a mass, and they go at the speed of light because they are the light particle. They go around the circle, this 27-kilometer circle, 11,000 times per second. And in terms of the energy that is stored in the Large Hadron Collider, the kinetic energy of this beam is equivalent to two small cruise ships of about 10 kiloton each, moving one against the other at about 30 kilometers per hour. Or, if you wanted to translate that into chocolate calories, someone tells me that it's about 16 kilograms of Swiss milk chocolate, if you were able to convert that into proton energy. It's also a very cold place because you need to keep these charged particles on a really big circle, and we do that by using really, really strong magnets. And to be that strong, they need to be operated at very low temperatures. So the Large Hadron Collider is nearly the coldest known place in the universe. It's only beaten by the Boomerang Nebula by a fraction of a centigrade degree. And we collide protons, and thanks to Einstein's world-famous E equal mc squared equation, we start with two protons, and we end up with lots and lots of different kinds of particles in the final state. And most of them would be well-known particles. Very interesting, but we wouldn't be building such a big machine, such an expensive machine, to look at known particles, doing kind of known things, expected things. So sometimes, in the midst of all those known particles, there will be a really special one, such as the Higgs boson that was discovered, as I said, in 2012, and which heard, and I apologize profusely to Professor Higgs in absentia for using this photo. I made sure that it was a kind of Creative Commons photo, so I wasn't offending anyone by using it. But it earned him and Professor Anglais the Nobel Prize in 2013, the next year, for the discovery. So we discovered, you got the Nobel Prize. Sometimes you can also have even kind of more exciting stuff coming out from the interaction, something that was either unexpected or maybe expected but never seen before. This unfortunately hasn't happened yet, but we remain hopeful, and we've got a lot of time before we make it to 100 years, like for gravitational waves. Leaving aside oranges and apples and bananas, I thought I should put something slightly more serious so that you don't think that we're just kind of playing video games when we do our science. So we get it's a rather messy affair, because protons aren't truly elementary particles. They're made of quarks, glued together by gluons. They are at very high energy, so there's a lot of activity happening within the gluons and the interaction amongst the protons. So there's lots of things that happen in the initial state, in the final state, and then finally we get particles in the outermost shell of this diagram, which are the ones that we see in our detector. And from this kind of messy thing, which is the only thing that we see, we need to figure out what happened here. Was a Higgs boson produced? Was new particles produced? Was it slightly boring physics that we still need to understand so that we can make the actual discoveries? So like data sleuths, we must, from cleverly chosen and kind of accurately measured clues, we must reconstruct the Mona Lisa smile from what are essentially pixelated versions and kind of sometimes blurry versions of the Mona Lisa. And we do that by using really gigantic detectors such as the ATLAS detector. This is my detector, our detector. There's lots of ATLAS collaborators in the room. This is a photo that was taken at the time when ATLAS was being constructed. Like essentially all the collider experiments, it has a cylindrical structure. You should imagine that the beam is coming from this blue pipe here, and there's an equivalent one coming from the back. And then there's lots of specialized sub-detectors wrapped around the beam pipe. The collision happens at the center, and all those particles, remember the apples and the oranges, they fly all over the place. And each one of those layers measures different things. And this is another view of the same detector. Around the same time, we are inserting kind of the innermost cylinder in the detector, a kind of rather tall person for scale standing on scaffolding. It's really, really big. In fact, it's as tall as the Brighton Pavilion and as heavy as the Eiffel Tower. It's a gigantic detector, which is tens of meters underground, and it wasn't a small engineering feat to construct it. So hat off also to all the engineers as well as the scientists, the physicists that have contributed to the construction of ATLAS. And you can think of the ATLAS detector as of some sort of gigantic digital camera, a very good, very expensive, very fast digital camera. There are about 100 million channels, digital channels in ATLAS, so that would correspond to a 100 megapixel camera, better than your iPhone, even if you got an iPhone 10. And it needs to take 40 million snaps per second, or in fact, not record 40 million snaps per second. I'll show in a second that that's not what we do, but that's the rate at which collisions happen in the middle of ATLAS, and we need to decide whether to keep those shots or not. In fact, like you would do on your iPhone, you take lots and lots of shots, but you only keep the best ones, particularly if you're running out of disk space. And you need to sift through your data and do that really, really rapidly, and it's often a case of looking for the needle in the haystack. And we do that in stages, so you got 40 million collisions per second. And then in various stages where the gold to dust ratio gets better and better, but obviously the sieving time also increases, we go from those 40 million snaps per second to only being able to keep 200 or roughly 200 snaps per second on permanent storage. And I kind of scoured the internet to figure out how many grains of sugar there would be in a kilogram of sugar, and I calculated that 40 million grains of white sugar is about 25 kilograms. So imagine that you, in a second, have to sieve 25 kilograms of white sugar and find 200 grains of brown sugar. And then one of them, maybe, is a grain of salt. And to do that every second, that's what the ATLAS detector is doing. And even though we throw away most of the data that we kind of produce, because they will contain boring physics that is already well known. Even though we do that, we still are left with a lot of data. About 130 petabytes, I think, is the entire data volume for ATLAS, which is quite a good contender to the entire Google search database and a yearly update of Facebook. But we have to look at really, really small distances. That means that as well as acting as some sort of very powerful digital camera, ATLAS also behaves functionally as some sort of super-duper microscope, exploring distances as small as, let me get this right, 1,000th of a billionth of a millimeter, 10 to the minus 15. So particle physics really has changed the way in which we understand science. We don't look at nature with the same eyes as particle physicists, because we understand, and we are privileged to understand it, by colliding particles and going to higher and higher energies, we can see more and more of the structure of nature. Nature has revealed itself, matter has revealed itself not to be continuous, but to be a rather discrete, granular entity with kind of properties that have some elegance and some patterns, and we go from understanding the atom as made of a nucleus with electrons orbiting around its kind of simplified solar model style of the atom. And then understanding that the nucleus isn't unbreakable, it's made of nucleons, the protons and the neutrons. So there's kind of compositeness within the nucleus. And then the nucleons themselves, the protons and the neutrons are not elementary themselves, as I said when I was talking about the proton-proton collisions. They are made of even more elementary particles, the quarks, glued together by the gluons. And all this symmetry and all this kind of also broken symmetries that we see are organized, as I said, in the standard model. And it's a kind of a game of Russian dolls where you kind of uncover similarities, patterns, but also differences. Those of you who've kind of contemplated Russian dolls know that they tell a story. So they're not exactly the same. And they show differences as well as similarities. And it's by looking at those patterns and similarities as well as broken symmetries that we have understood what we know about particle physics. In this wheel, as I said, we got quarks at the top and leptons, which is the electron and kind of heavier cousins, and then electrically neutral and also very, very light partners called the neutrinos. There's lots and lots of neutrinos going through our bodies as we speak. They are produced abundantly in the atmosphere and also in the sun. But ordinary matter, you and I and this table, and everything, stars, nebulae, everything that we observe through some magnifying object is made primarily of up quarks, down quarks, and electrons. All the other particles can be produced, them, but typically you obtain them through some kind of high energy particle process, particle collision or maybe decay. And I said that these particles are the matter particles that interact with one another by exchanging the force particles. And there are four known forces in nature, but only three of them are described by the standard model. Gravity, which is perhaps astoundingly the one that possibly we have better perception and kind of understanding of, at least on a superficial level, is not described by the standard model. It's not that it's not described because it's done so and so, it's just not included in the standard model at all. But all the other three forces, electromagnetism, which is mediated by the exchange of the light particles, the photons, and which is responsible for electricity and magnetism. And then we have nuclear forces, the strong force, which is mediated by the gluon. And then we have the weak force, which is mediated by the exchange of W and Z particles, and is responsible, for example, for radioactivity or for the fusion processes in the sun. And then we have this kind of special part that I will touch upon in a second. And I was mentioning patterns, and one interesting pattern in my view in the standard model is kind of the mass hierarchy that we have. So some of the particles, such as the light quarks, the up quark, the down quark, and the strange quark, which is kind of some strange, as the name says, behaves slightly differently from the up and the down, but it's still a light quark. So nearly masses, but not quite. And then most of the charged neutrinos, the electron and the muon, and then all of the, charged leptons, and all of the neutrinos are all very, very light. And then there are exactly massless particles. We have the photon and we have the gluon. And they are not nearly massless. They are exactly massless in the theory. And then we have the giants and the kind of heavyweights of the theory. We have the heavier quarks, the charm, and the top, which is actually the heaviest of all the measured particles. And then we have the tau lepton, which is not quite as heavy as all the others, but heavier than the other lepton counterparts. And then the W and the Z. The W, the Z, and the top are in the range of 100 times heavier than a proton. How comes that we have masses that are different from zero? how comes that these particles have different masses? And one elegant way to explain that is to imagine that the space is, in fact, it's more than imagined. We know now for a fact that there exists a thing called the Higgs field, which you can think of as some sort of kind of slithery molasses where all the particles travel through space and kind of are slowed down in different measure in proportion to how much they interact with the Higgs field. And then that's the reason why they have different masses, because they interact differently with this Higgs field, this kind of Higgs molasses in space. And one manifestation of the Higgs field is the existence of the Higgs boson. So it isn't the Higgs boson that explains the masses, the Higgs field and the Higgs mechanism, but the Higgs boson is the experimental proof that the Higgs field exists and that the Higgs mechanism explains how elementary particles acquire their mass. Now, is this the end of the story? Some people like to think, yes. A lot of my colleagues, the kind of pragmatic type of people, keep telling me, why do you still search for supersymmetry? The Sun model is perfect. But it isn't. This one, I dug out. I've learned so much while I was preparing this talk about cartographers and Flammaur, and I've also learned that this is the Spilbury jigsaw puzzle, apparently from 1766. Apparently, it's the first known example of purpose-made jigsaw puzzle. It's kept by the British Library, so it must be important. And it reminds me of the Sunday model, because it's. I think it's quite beautiful. It's a beautiful jigsaw. I wish I had it. And also, it describes quite a lot, in quite a lot of detail, of the known world, Western world. Europe in particular, but it has holes. And this is true for the standard model. It is a beautiful model. First of all, it's a model, it isn't a theory, so it's kind of more descriptive than kind of starting necessary from first principles. But then, it also, how to say, it lacks in many ways. One of the ways in which the standard model is lacking, I have already mentioned. I said straight away, the standard model describes three forces, but one of them, the one that we are more used to experiencing, gravity, isn't there at all. It's just ignored, full stop. So we know, if nothing else, that the standard model can be the final theory because it isn't describing gravity. And we haven't got a quantum theory for gravity yet. People are working really hard to get there, but we haven't got that. And then, kind of drawing from my past as a neutrino physicist, from the time when neutrino oscillations were being discovered, before neutrino oscillations were discovered, people were quite happy that the standard model assumes neutrinos to be exactly massless. However, if neutrinos were all exactly massless, we couldn't have neutrino oscillation. There would be no way that neutrino oscillations could exist in nature. The fact that they exist is proof that the neutrinos are not massless. So that's another problem, because in the standard model, neutrinos are massless. And then I've been kind of filling your head with thoughts of dark matter, and that's a big mystery that is screaming to be solved. And the standard model doesn't even attempt to do that. There's nothing in the standard model that gives us an explanation or a description or any insight as to what dark matter is made of. In this light, I'm kind of trying to draw your attention to the balance in the universe, the cosmic recipe, as I've called it, what we know and cherish ourselves, this planet, the stars, the planets in the solar system, our galaxy, all the galaxies, our kind of the cluster of galaxies where our galaxy lives, and the rest of the universe that we can see through telescopes, at various wavelengths. All of that only makes up 5% of the universe. There's 95% of the universe that we don't know what it's made of. But by studying maps such as the cosmic microwave background variation map that I showed you earlier, it is possible, through really clever analysis and knowing a lot of physics and a lot of maths and admirations for those who produced those beautiful results with very high precision, we know that 3/4 of the universe are made of something that we don't know what it is, except that it's a force that repels gravity, and it's called dark energy. And it's not the job of particle physics at the moment to address that kind of question. The Large Hadron Collider cannot say anything about dark energy. Too bad. But the remaining quarter, or what is left after we subtract that small 5% that is ordinary matter, that quarter is called dark matter. And we have indirect experimental proof that it exists. We know that it's matter. It isn't a force. And we call it dark because we don't know what it is and we can't see it through a telescope. But the clever thing is that it could be that the Large Hadron Collider might produce dark matter, and maybe we will be able to say something about it. And maybe we'll be able to shed some light, not on the entire kind of balance of what is contained in the universe, but at least to go from knowing only 5% to knowing what's in there for a quarter of the total balance. So ATLAS is a digital camera, and it's a very powerful microscope. In a very broad sense, it's also a very powerful telescope, because by looking at the infinitely small physics of elementary particles, we can kind of raise our heads and kind of also explore the cosmos and the very large scales of the cosmos. And one really theory beyond the standard model, remember that the standard model has holes, so there needs to be something beyond it. One really exciting and theory that theorists also like because of its elegance is called supersymmetry. And this is kind of the last 15 years or so of my career since I started to work on ATLAS. And what supersymmetry does, it kind of creates a mirror image, but slightly distorted mirror image of the standard model particles. We already have some mirroring because we got matter and antimatter. This is different from that kind of mirroring. These are particles which are quite similar to the standard model particles in the way in which they interact, but they're also heavier. We think that they will be heavier. The reason why we think that they will be heavier is that we haven't seen them yet, so they must be at some higher energy that we haven't been able to explore yet, and that the Large Hadron Collider is able to probe. And they will also behave slightly differently. For example, they would behave differently in the presence of magnetic forces. So it is possible, and I see here the knitter of this lovely neutralina sitting at the back. This is a kind of a small creature that we invented for a Royal Society exhibition where we were trying to kind of explain to people what supersymmetry is. This is the neutralina. The beauty of supersymmetry that has to do with dark matter. There's lots of beautiful points about supersymmetry that makes it an appealing theory. And the fact that it kind of in many of its incarnations it predicts the existence of a particle called the neutralina, which if it exists and if we hope to see it, kind of ticks all the boxes for which kind of properties we would expect for dark matter. It's electrically neutral, it doesn't interact very much, and supposedly should be quite heavy. Now the thing is that there are lots and lots of supersymmetric models. And kind of like this little cat looking in the mirror and looking for a more powerful, more kind of heavier and possibly more beautiful incarnation of itself. We have to it's a hard job to have to look for something that you don't know how it looks like. So we kind of have that challenge. And also we have the challenge that there are many ways in which supersymmetry could realize itself. In fact, we wouldn't care. I'm sure that my colleagues who, like myself, are looking for supersymmetry would agree. We wouldn't care if we didn't find supersymmetry as long as we find something new. But it's really difficult, and we have to probe all these different models that that are there. And how do we do that? Well, we have to analyze all the data that we collect, and we have to look for features, and we have to look for patterns, and then we have to compare our experimental measurements to the predictions. And first of all, your predictions need to be really accurate, and then your measurements need to be equally accurate. And then it might very well be that either to decide whether your observations are compatible with the standard model. So unfortunately, there's no evidence for new physics. Or if you find something that doesn't quite agree with the standard model, but you don't know what it is, you have to spend a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of kind of brain power to figure out what it is that you're seeing. And sometimes it's not that easy to distinguish especially if you remember the blurry image. If you got a blurry image, can you distinguish between the real Mona Lisa or the copy that Leonardo's clever apprentice also produced around the same time when the Mona Lisa was painted? They look pretty similar, don't they? So if you only had like a low resolution version of this image, maybe not with a lot of color, you might be fooled. So you need to improve your resolution on your experiments. You need to improve, and this is where our theoretician friends come to help. You need to really be able to see that Mona Lisa smile. What makes the Mona Lisa special is the smile. It isn't not only, anyway, the beautiful landscape in the background, it isn't the clothing, it's the smile, it's what the Mona Lisa is famous for. And if you look at the two images, this is really where you could perhaps see and recognize the difference between the two. But you have to look really, really close, and you have to be really, really kind of attentive to detail and precise in what you do. And the lines I had, you know, I had the thicker lines, and then you get the thinner lines, and the band in my kind of description represents how precise you are. And before you couldn't distinguish which one of the two lines was overlapping. Was it the black, was it the red one that was overlapping with the blue? But then if the uncertainty becomes smaller, now you can see that it's the red that agrees with the blue in this region here. And so you can distinguish between competing theories. And then you figure out that the holes were Scotland and the English Channel, the Netherlands and Sardinia in the Spielberg jigsaw. And this has kind of taken me very, very rapidly towards the end of my lecture. And I wanted to give you a sense of what it is to be a scientist, of what it is to be a particle physicist. I didn't think that it would be too interesting for you to know how many bolts and nuts there are in the detector that we constructed, or how many lines of code we have written, or how many exclusion plots of supersymmetry doesn't seem to be willing to show up just yet we have produced. I just wanted you to give to go away with the same sense of wonder that we have. There's a whole terra incognita in front of us, and I think it's just beautiful that this generation of particle physicists have the privilege to do that. We've been start for data for quite a long time, but now there's like a feast, and stuffing our face with data and producing hundreds of papers every year, but we haven't found physics beyond the standard model yet. We remain hopeful. The Large Hadron Collider is, in my view, one in a lifetime type of chance. In fact, I think it's one in a 50 years type of chance. We have been running since 2008-09. The first part of the data taking was at the lower energy that we expected. Not we expected, kind of the design, the intended final energy for the machine. We took a lot of data, and we discovered the Higgs boson. That was an early present from the Large Hadron Collider, which kind of raised expectation. Oh, the next day we'll be discovering physics beyond the standard model. But really, it's a painstaking, long-drawn process. And that's why I wanted to draw your attention on the necessity to have precise calculation, precise measurements, a lot of data. We are now in the middle of round two. The energy has nearly reached the design energy. The intensity of the beams is essentially at design. But we are already envisaging further upgrades of the machine, further upgrades of our detector. It is a program that will last for another 20 years. And I'm thinking of retirement age at this point. But this is the stuff of physics textbook. This isn't just one discovery and then you're done. This is kind of really rewriting and writing a whole new chapter for particle physics. And maybe one day we're all kind of on the lookout for newfound land. Maybe one day we'll be screaming Terra, Terra. And I hope that you will continue to follow this journey. And I hope that you enjoyed this excursus of my most recent part of my career. So thank you very much for listening.